1, and then going on to verse 12. But on the first day of the week, at early dawn, they went to the tomb, taking the spices they had prepared. And they found the stone rolled away from the tomb. But when they went in, they did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. While they were perplexed about this, behold, two men stood by them in dazzling apparel. And as they were frightened and bowed their faces to the ground, the men said to them, "Why do you seek the living among the dead? He is not here, but is risen. Remember how he told you, while he was still in Galilee, that the Son of Man must be delivered into the hands of sinful men and be crucified and on the third day rise." And they remembered his words, and returning from the tomb, they told all of these things to the 11 and to all the rest. Now it was Mary Magdalene and Joanna and Mary, the mother of James, and the other women with them who told these things to the apostles. But these words seemed to them an idle tale, and they did not believe them. But Peter rose and ran to the tomb, stooping and looking in. He saw the linen cloths by themselves and went home, marveling at what had happened.
So I might have mentioned this before, but a few years ago, I was chatting with a neighbor of mine. It was the week leading up to Easter, and he asked me the question. He was like, "Hey, man, are you ready for Super Bowl Sunday?" And at first, I was a little confused because it was like April, but then he followed it up. He was like, "Well, like, isn't Easter pretty much like your version of the Super Bowl?" And I sort of laughed it off at first, but then I agreed. I'm like, yeah, this is like our biggest Sunday of the year. But as I started to think about it, the Super Bowl, it's one of these cultural events that has the ability to sort of draw in people who have no interest in the sport of football, right? But Easter doesn't really feel that way when you really get to the heart of the Easter message, like especially in comparison to Christmas. And you can really get a sense of this when you look at popular music. So like here's a list of some of the bands that produced Christmas albums. The 80s hair band Twisted Sister, Christmas album. The band Weezer, they have a Christmas album. All right, the rapper Snoop Dogg, he has a Christmas album. Conversely, I cannot name a single Grammy-winning artist who has so much as produced a single on Easter. And I think the reason why is that everybody can get on board with the idea of Jesus' birth. That's not very controversial that there was a historical figure named Jesus who walked the earth 2,000 years ago. But the resurrection, now that's a different story. That's a little bit more far-fetched. And the fact of the matter is, like, we've witnessed births all the time. But none of us have seen a literal resurrection from the dead. That takes a real leap of faith. And so when you look at the real core of the Easter message, it feels like it's the type of message, the type of day that really separates believers on one hand and unbelievers on the other. Well, if that's the case, then why do Christians make such a big deal about Easter, the most controversial belief in the Christian anthology? I mean, if it's that big of a stumbling block for people, then why don't we bump Easter from Super Bowl status and just make it the equivalent of like a preseason NFL game? Right? Or maybe better yet, we make it like the equivalent of a closed spring practice that only friends of the program get to witness. And I think the reason why is because the Bible forces us to put the resurrection at the very center of Christianity. There are actually only 12 events in Jesus' life that appear in all four gospel accounts. The resurrection is one of those 12 events, but also the resurrection is given top billing status in all four gospel accounts. And then you've got the problem of the most famous theologian in church history, a guy named the Apostle Paul. Now, if you don't know his story, I'm not going to get too far into it, but Paul was a man who violently persecuted anyone who believed in the resurrection of Jesus. But then there was a moment where he met the resurrected Jesus himself. He converted to Christianity. He ended up writing over half of the New Testament. And then in a letter that he wrote to a church in the city of Corinth, here's what he had to say about the resurrection now. He said, if Christ has not been raised, then our preaching is in vain and your faith is in vain. Right, in other words, if the resurrection didn't happen, Paul says, just forget religion altogether. Give up this idea of going to church. And guys like me, we need to start looking for a new job. Christianity doesn't hang on whether you agree with all of Jesus' teachings. Christianity hangs on whether you believe in the literal, physical resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth. And so, for that reason, Easter feels like one of these days that is reserved for only the most faithful of believers. But what I want us to see this morning is that if you look at the original story of the resurrection in Luke's gospel, what I think you're going to find is that the resurrection, oddly enough, is for unbelievers. This morning, I want us to see three forms of unbelief that are displayed in Luke's account of that Sunday morning when Jesus rose from the dead. And I want to tell you that the three forms of unbelief that we're going to talk about. So first, you have those who struggle to believe that they have value. Second, you have those who struggle with shame. And third, you have those who struggle with doubts. All right, so first, let's look at those who struggle to believe that they have value. Verse 1 of our passage, it begins, but on the first day of the week, at early dawn, they went to the tomb, taking the spices they had prepared, and they found the stone rolled away from the tomb. Well, you have to go all the way to verse 10 to figure out who the they were, and we find out there. It says, now it was Mary Magdalene and Joanna and Mary the mother of James and the other women with them who told these things to the apostles. And so according to Luke's account, the angels were there to greet this group of women. Now, we learn from Matthew's account that upon these women running to tell the disciples about what they just witnessed, they are greeted by none other than Jesus himself. And Jesus says to these women, greetings. Do not be afraid, but go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee. And there, they will see me for the first time. All of the writers of the Gospels make it clear that the individuals who were first brought into the story of the resurrection are women. Now, we are 21st century people, and because of that, we sort of take for granted all of the progress that's been made in terms of gender equality, women's rights. And so we don't necessarily make much of the fact that women were the first eyewitnesses to the resurrected Jesus. But you got to consider the fact that this book was written 2,000 years ago. And in the ancient culture, women were viewed as second-class citizens. Their voice did not have value, culturally speaking. In fact, according to ancient laws, their testimony, the testimony of a woman, wasn't even admissible in a court of law. Did you notice how the disciples responded when the women first came into the room with the news of the resurrection? Well, we're told about it in verse 11. And here's what Luke says. But these words seemed to the disciples an idle tale, and they did not believe them. Now, I think the reason the disciples responded this way is in part because of who the messengers were. These were women. They weren't really credible, culturally speaking. Surely this couldn't have happened. Now, the real question then is, why would the resurrected Jesus choose to make women the first eyewitnesses when, culturally speaking, they would not have lended credibility to the fact that Jesus, in fact, rose from the dead? Well, I think it's Jesus' way of speaking into the hearts of people who struggle to feel, culturally speaking, that they have value. The resurrection of Jesus, it is the beginning of the dignification of women in the world, period. Right? The resurrection is the moment in world history where the status of women began to change. It starts with the resurrection. You know, Jesus, he used the resurrection as really a platform to begin the work of restoring human dignity. And he began with Mary Magdalene, sort of as a representation for all the women who came before her and all those who would come after, to declare that in his resurrection, in the person of Jesus, you have somebody who will give you more value than any man ever has or ever will. And here's where I think really all of us can learn from the example of these women. When we start to believe that the resurrection gives us value, we start to become a people who have the courage to give value to others. So our family is a huge fan of the musical Hamilton. I don't know if y'all have seen it or not. The musical Hamilton is the story of the life of Alexander Hamilton, who's the $10 founding father. Without a father, you got a lot farther by working a lot harder, by being a lot smarter. Gosh, we know so many of the songs on here verbatim. Now, one of the more haunting songs in the musical, it's this song called Burn. And this song, it's sung by Hamilton's wife, Eliza, in response to her husband becoming the subject of the first public scandal in American history, after Alexander has an affair. And there's this one line in the song in particular that really caught my ear. Here's what she sings. "I'm erasing myself from the narrative. Let future historians wonder how Eliza reacted when you broke her heart. You, Alexander, have torn it all apart. I am watching it burn, watching it burn." She's speaking about this really raw moment where Eliza feels as if her husband had completely stripped her of any value that she thought she had. And from that moment on in the musical, she does exactly what she claimed. She disappears from the musical. She fades to black. But then when you get to the end of the musical, Hamilton is killed in a duel with Aaron Burr. And if you're like, you just ruined the musical for me, like, this is a historical event that happened over 200 years ago. You can't blame me for ruining this. But at the very end of the movie, Hamilton, he's killed by Aaron Burr. And out of nowhere, here comes Eliza. And she suddenly appears on stage. And she begins with these words, "I put myself back into the narrative." And then she goes on to sing about how she lived another 50 years. And among many other contributions, she founded the first private orphanage in New York City. And so one of the things that happens is you leave this musical realizing that the real hero of this musical, it isn't the $10 founding father without a father. The real hero may in fact be Eliza Hamilton. There's a similar story arc that Jesus has given to Mary Magdalene. she and her friends came to Jesus' tomb expecting a funeral. But instead, what they discovered is that the God of the universe has noticed them and has brought them into the narrative of the single most important event in human history. The resurrection is for people who are convinced that this is the day that I'm walking into a funeral. The resurrection is for people who feel as if they're in dead-end jobs, people who feel they have a deadbeat spouse, people who feel like they're on the wrong side of a deadbolt lock. When the resurrection hits home for a person, like the women in this story, what happens is they suddenly find themselves stepping into the narrative of this world with the hope of the gospel. They end up making it their mission to tell others about the resurrection of Jesus and that it was for them. Second, the resurrection, it's for people who struggle with shame. So I've already referenced the fact that the disciples, like they completely dismissed the resurrection at first. But that's not totally true. There was actually one disciple who listened to Mary and these other women. And so in verse 12, here's what Luke writes. We're told that Peter rose and ran to the tomb, stooping and looking in. He saw the linen cloths by themselves, and he went home marveling at what had happened. Now, it's actually ironic that of all the disciples, Peter is the first one to get on board with the resurrection of Jesus. And the reason why is if you know Peter's story, you know that of all the disciples, the one disciple who was the most resistant towards Jesus' incessant talks about his death and resurrection was Peter. He struggled to believe that Jesus would die and rise again 3 days more than any other disciple. So why is it that he's the first disciple to want to run towards the tomb and see it? Well, you have to know a little bit about Peter's story. I don't think it's a coincidence that Peter also happens to be the disciple who's probably the most paralyzed by his own personal shame and ministry failure. So Peter is the disciple who, when Jesus was arrested, he was the one who denied even knowing Jesus on 3 separate occasions. And so what I think is going on here on this particular Sunday morning is when these women came into the room with the news of the resurrection, it meant something personal for Peter. It's almost as if ever since this moment, Peter has been weighed down by this huge boulder of shame. And for every hour that passed since that time that he had denied even knowing Jesus, it's as if the weight of that shame carried more and more weight. But then all of a sudden, when the news of the resurrection came, unlike the other disciples, he didn't care who the messenger was. All he knows is that with the news of Jesus' resurrection, it started to mean that the burden was coming off. Peter's guilt was starting to lose its power. His shame was starting to break loose. It's as if the metaphorical shackles that had been tying Peter down and his past mistakes, they were starting to be broken loose. The resurrection means that if God can overcome death, then is there really anything in my past that Jesus cannot overcome? This is precisely what Peter was starting to realize on this particular Sunday morning. You know, part of what makes the Bible so compelling to me, this has always been true, is when you get past maybe some of the Sunday school versions of the Bible stories that maybe we heard growing up in church, the Bible has this gritty realism to it. And when you look a little deeper, what you'll discover is that over and over again, the Bible is filled with stories of people who are incredibly honest about their most shameful moments. I mean, it's sort of an expose, so to speak, of all the worst faults and sins and examples of brokenness in the lives of people that we are called to look at as the giants upon whose shoulders we're called to walk out on faith. You know, the gospel writers themselves, it's interesting. They go out of their way to expose their greatest ministry failures. And I really think it's a great picture of what the Church of Jesus Christ is supposed to look like. You know, I don't know if this is true for you, but I'm sure there have been examples in your past where you sort of feel like if there's one community where you feel like you have to put on your best religious face, that you've got it all together, it's often felt like it's the church. Like, this isn't the safe place where you can bring your brokenness. But the story of the Gospels and the early church tells a really different story. And if I can, you know, even brag on our church, one of the things I've loved about Midtown Church is it's really the best church I've ever been a part of in terms of being a community where you can be honest about your shame and the broken parts of your stories. Like, I've never experienced a church that's more committed to helping people to find the power of the resurrection, even in the worst parts of their lives. And I think it's true. The only shame in your life that will ever have power over you is the shame that you don't have the courage to bring before Jesus. The resurrection starts to change that. Third, the resurrection, it's for people with doubts. You know, I already mentioned this, that the disciples, their immediate response to the news of the resurrection, it's found in verse 11, right? We're told, but these words seemed to them an idle tale, and they did not believe them. Now, earlier I referenced the fact that part of this is the fact that they were the product of what was a sexist culture in Jesus' day. But there's another variable going on here. They are just as much a product of their own skepticism. You know, I've interacted with a number of skeptics over the years, particularly as it regards this belief in the historical resurrection of Jesus. And admittedly, there's no escaping the fact that Christianity, at least at this point in our context, 2019, is built upon believing in an event that took place 2,000 years ago. But what if we were debating an event that happened this morning, just 3 hours ago? That's what's happening with the disciples. The disciples doubted the resurrection in spite of a group of people testifying that they themselves had just seen the resurrected Jesus. And it isn't as if these are strangers who were talking to them. No, no, no. These women, these are their friends. These are their ministry partners, people that they have been working alongside of the past 3 years. And not only that, the disciples had heard directly from Jesus himself on 3 separate occasions. Guys, I'm going to die, but 3 days later, I am going to rise from the dead. And these guys had already witnessed Jesus perform numerous miracles that we've only read about. And if you know the story of the crucifixion just 2 days earlier, you know that there were several supernatural occurrences that took place at the moment of Jesus' death. We're told earlier in the gospel accounts that there were reports that as soon as Jesus died, a couple of things happened. One, the sky went completely dark in the middle of the day. And we're also told that there was an earthquake that happened right at the moment that Jesus gave up his last breath. And in the Gospel of Matthew, we're told that there was a Roman centurion. He was never a follower of Jesus. But the reality of seeing Jesus die and the reality of just having witnessed a resurrection, he was able to figure out that Jesus was something more than a mere man. He converted to Christianity on the spot without having even seen the resurrection. And yet, right here, we've got 11 guys who spent 3 years with Jesus, and their skepticism was so strong that it seemed to them that this is an idle tale. But I think this is really the beauty of the story of the resurrection. Jesus decided to build his kingdom on the skepticism of these 11 guys. The resurrection is a story of the God of the universe wrapping his arms around a bunch of fearful, scared, and skeptical men and women. As I referenced with the Apostle Paul, Jesus would end up designated a man who violently persecuted Christians as the guy who would write almost half the New Testament. Here's what I think it means to be a resurrection people when it comes to our skepticism and doubts. The resurrection invites doubters and skeptics. It invites your questions. I heard one pastor say this, that doubt is often a sign that your faith has a pulse. That it's alive and well, it's exploring, and it's even searching. Faith and doubt are not opposites. They are, as it turns out, excellent dance partners. You know, years ago, when I wrestled with the claims of the historical resurrection of Jesus, without a doubt, the most compelling evidence for the resurrection, in my case, was really the people that I started hanging out with who were changed by believing in Jesus. It was their changed lives that really drew me in. It was only when I had the courage to really step into Christian community and see how they were being shaped by this belief in the death and resurrection of Jesus that I really started to see the credence of this ancient belief. And really, honestly, to this day, like the most unexplainable event surrounding the resurrection is the fact that following Jesus's death, all of his followers, which were probably around 100 people at the time, they all scattered. Right? They head for the hills. But then all of a sudden, 3 days later, they suddenly changed. And it not only changed the perspective of these 11 disciples, but suddenly there were over 10,000 people who became followers of Jesus. And they did this even in the knowledge that all of a sudden to be a follower of Jesus meant that you were going to be persecuted and at risk of death. And at this point, we're not talking about merely what the Bible itself says, but there are numerous works of ancient antiquity that have confirmed that the most explosive growth of Christianity took place beginning 3 days after the death of their leader. There was a guy, Ravi Zacharias. He was a Hindu converted to Christianity. And this was part of what converted him to putting his faith in Jesus. And he writes about this in one of his books. He sort of became a defender for Christianity. And he said this. He said, it all seems so simplistic, does it not? A group of gullible, pre-scientific men succumbing to the illusions and deceptions of their day, yet every piece of evidence mustered, including the unexplainable change in the courage and confidence of early believers, supported by the empirical evidence, argues powerfully for the truth of it all. You know, what I really love most about the resurrection is it tells a different story than the one we may feel culturally speaking. The resurrection, it isn't a dividing line that separates believers from unbelievers. The resurrection is an invitation. It's an invitation to all types of people. To those who struggle to believe that they have any value, the resurrection is an invitation to enter into the narrative of the most important event in human history. To those who feel weighed down by their shame, the resurrection is an invitation to be set free. To those who are filled with doubts and questions, the resurrection is an invitation to bring those questions, to bring those doubts, and to explore the claims of Jesus. N.T. Wright, he said this, it's on the front of your bulletin as well. He said, you know, if Jesus means that Jesus only rose in a spiritual sense, well, then it can only change the personal spiritual life. But if he truly rose from the dead, Christianity becomes good news for the whole world. You know, the sacrament of communion, I really view the sacrament of communion as an opportunity for us to make the decision if we're going to accept the invitation of the resurrection. And what I love about the sacrament of communion is it reminds us over and over again, this is not a table for the spiritual elites of this world. This isn't a table for people who have perfect faith and who live perfect lives. It's reserved for people who, like Mary, struggle to believe that they have value. It's a table for people like Peter, who this past week have felt really weighed down by the shame of their past. And it's for people like the disciples, who would love to say they don't have any doubt whatsoever, but they do. This table is really for any person who's come to a point where they have the courage to believe that they can bring whatever it is that they think might have disqualified them from being part of God's kingdom. And they have the courage to bring them before the Jesus who died on the cross 2,000 years ago and 3 days later rose from the dead for you. This meal's for anybody who's put their faith in Jesus and believes that Jesus rose for them. So let me say this. If there's anyone here who isn't sure whether they're ready to respond to the invitation of the resurrection in their life, we want you to know this here at Midtown Community Church. We celebrate the sacrament of communion every week. And so there is no statute of limitations on the invitation to this table. And so what this means is I want this to give anybody here the freedom that if you're not sure that you really buy into the resurrection of Jesus, if you're not sure that you buy into the narrative of Jesus' death on the cross for your sins and his resurrection 3 days later on your behalf, then I want you to feel the freedom that you don't have to take communion. We don't want you to feel pressured to take a meal that feels like it's inauthentic with where you're at personally. But here's what we want you to know. This is a place where you can bring your questions, you can bring your doubts, and you can earnestly seek and search and know that we offer this sacrament of communion every Sunday so that whenever you come to a point in your life where you can say, I'm beginning to put my faith in the person and work of Jesus Christ, we offer this table gladly and openly to anyone who is looking to bring themselves before the person and work of Jesus. Now, if you are here to take communion this morning, Jesus wants to remind us that on the night before he was betrayed, he took the bread, he broke it, he gave it to his disciples, and he said, this represents my body that was broken for you. And in the same manner, after the supper, he took the cup. He said, this cup represents my blood that was shed for many for the forgiveness of sins. Drink from it, all of you. Now, if this is your first time taking communion here at Midtown Community Church, here's how we do communion logistically. We'll ask that when you're ready, you'll come up front to receive the elements. You'll pinch off a piece of bread. If you need a gluten-free option, you can receive that in my line. And then you'll take a cup of grape juice from every tray. And then you'll bring the elements back to your seat after everybody's been served. I will then lead us so that we as a community of faith can proclaim in word and deed that he is risen indeed. And so we'll take the sacrament of communion together. Let me pray, and if those who are serving would come forward at this time. Heavenly Father, we come before you this morning. And maybe this past week, we've found ourselves looking for value in everything but in you, Jesus. Maybe we're feeling some shame this morning, and we've never really been sure what to do with it other than just try to stuff it under a rug or somewhere else. Maybe we have a lot of doubts, more than we wish we had. I thank you for the sacrament of communion, because it reminds us that Jesus, you came for doubters, you came for skeptics, you came for strugglers, you came for people who often find themselves looking for love in all the wrong places. But Jesus, you invite all these types of people here this morning, and you ask us to hear the words that those women gave to disciples many years ago, and to hear that these words are for us today. That Jesus, who died, has risen again for us. And so I pray that you would give us the courage, like Peter, to get up and to run towards the sacrament of communion, because here is where we find power to overcome whatever it is that we think would hold us back from putting our faith in you. Use this meal towards that end this morning. In Jesus' name, amen.